My name is Laura Lane. It's May 29th, 2013, and I'm talking once again with Jerry Apps, writer, author, and rural historian. Thanks for agreeing to do round two.
Sure.
I want to talk about your first book and how that came about. Mm-hmm. And you talked last time about writing the weekly columns for the Argus and about your mentor, Robert Gard, and how you had taken the columns and talked to him about the possibility of turning those columns into a book. Can you tell us a little bit about how he helped you and how you, the process of your first book?
Mm-hmm. I had been writing a column for probably 4 years or so. I'd started writing the column in 1966 when I was in graduate school. And I, by 1970, I had the column was appearing in four newspapers, and I was getting good reaction to it. And I had always wanted to write a book. Robert Gard was Wisconsin's folklorist and a novelist and nonfiction writer and historian, and someone whom I had respected. I had read his work, and I knew him because he had helped me when I was a county extension agent in Brown County. And his office was in Agricultural Hall, which is where my office was at the time when I was teaching in the College of Agriculture. And one day I took a handful of these columns into his office and said to him, is there a possibility that I could have these columns reprinted into a book? And his first comment was one that I found very interesting. He said, you could do that, but a book really needs to be more than a collection of columns. And I've never forgotten that. That was a very important point. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? He said, well, for a book to really work well, it needs to have a storyline. No matter if it's a fiction book or a nonfiction book. And he said, clearly you're writing a nonfiction. And he said, the story is extremely important, no matter what form of writing you're planning to do. There's a few exceptions. And I listened to him very carefully, and I said, well, how might I do that? And he said, well, take your columns and look for themes, look for threads. Look for the possibility of what the storyline might be in these columns. And I never thought about that because I was writing these columns once every week. I had to have them in the mail every Monday morning, and I didn't pay any attention to any kind of theme other than they were all based on nature and the environment. That was the thread because the column was titled Outdoor Notebook. And so I thought about that for a while, and then I began thinking about, well, if he means story, and I had, by that time, I've always read lots of fiction, so I knew intuitively, I guess, what a story was, and my dad was a storyteller, and I'd become some kind of a storyteller. So I tried to put all that together in terms of how to do this book, and I struggled with what should be the characters. Who should be the characters? Well, the book turned out to be a kind of memoir, so I'm the writer, the author. I'm one of the characters, but I also and this was, I don't know how I came up with this, but and it's based on our farm that we have now. The book ended up. That was the overriding focus of the book. But what about the farm? And I started with by talking about an old willow windbreak, a black willow windbreak that was on the west side of our farmstead, and that had been planted. I had ferreted out all this history in 1912, and the end willow I chose then as one of my characters. The end willow in a string of black willow trees. A gnarled and weather-beaten old tree with branches that were torn and cracked, and it was a fascinating old tree. And I wrote about this. I wrote that in the first chapter of this book. And Bob said to me, when you've done a first chapter, so bring it to me and let me have a look at it. And so I thought I was really with it. This black willow I thought that was just genius. So I wrote this whole thing up. I took it into him, and Bob Gard was a Kansas farm boy. And he had a very wry sense of humor, and he talked in kind of a slow and careful way. And I turned this into him, and then a couple of days later, I came back to talk with him. And he had the manuscript on his desk, and I didn't say anything, and I sat across from him, expecting to receive all this praise for how wonderful this work was, because he was a writing teacher, and I had really worked hard at this. He looked me right in the eye, and he said, "Jerry, this is pretty interesting, but you know, you really don't know that old willow very well." I said, "What do you mean I don't know it very well? I've known it since we've had the farm." He said, "Well, what you need to do, Jerry, is you need to get out, sit under that old tree in the summer, breezes are rustling the leaves, and sit under that old tree in the winter when the branches are bare and the wind is howling through the tops of the tree, that old tree. And I want you to tell me what it tastes like." "What do you mean, what does it taste like?" "Well, you should taste the bark and get some sense of that. And I want to feel that bark. I want to feel what you describe through your eyes as something that's kind of interesting and old and gnarled. But I want you to tell me that through all of your senses." And so I was dismayed and disappointed and thought, "My gosh, as hard as I've worked on this, I still hadn't gotten it right." And I did what he said. And that's a very important lesson, because I learned that so often we record what it is that we see and what we hear, but there are three other senses that we ought to pay attention to every so often as well. We ought to pay attention to what something tastes like, and what something feels like. We need to have all of the senses working. And so that became one of my guiding lights, so to speak, as I then developed the theme for this book, the history of the very first settlers. Tom Stewart, Civil War veteran, arrived there in 1867. A homestead, he received it as a homestead by virtue of having been a Civil War veteran. He had to prove up, meaning he had to live there for 5 years and build buildings. And I told that story. I told the story of how the land was broken and how when he had arrived in 1867, which was late because it was still federal land, the county had been surveyed in 1851 and the land had become available for sale. But because it was such poor farm, it remained federal property until 1867. And then I told about what it looked like as best I could figure out from doing the research and digging out the accounts of other people, and how this prairie that I now am restoring was a vast sea of big blue-stemmed grass waving in the wind, and how he had hired neighbors with oxen, three yoke of oxen and a breaking plow to turn over this vast area of big blue stem and plant it to wheat. And so that's the story I told all the way through the book.
I want to go back to something you said. You said when you talked with Mr. Gard and he'd given you this feedback, you were very surprised. You said you did what he said. Did that mean you went and actually sat under the tree?
I did.
And did you in all seasons?
I did.
Tell me a little bit of, you did.
Well, I did all of that.
And I'm
still doing that.
So when you went and, you know, he said, "What does it taste like? What does it feel like?"
Mm-hmm.
How did you then, I mean, I get the sense that you thought his advice was right, but how did it make your writing better to go sit under that tree and be under that tree?
Well, his advice told me that we as human beings have, I said a little of this before, have five senses, and they all need to be brought into play. And it's the duty of the writer to write in such a way that the person reading the material is has a sense of sitting right beside you and hearing what you hear and seeing what you see, feeling what you feel, tasting what you taste, all of the rest of it.
And that's no easy task.
That's right. That's a challenging task. But that to me separates the writer who is interested in doing an in-depth piece of work from one who is doing, and this sounds a little crass, a quick and dirty write-up of something or another.
Mm-hmm. How did you then, and tell me about the actual process of getting your first book published?
Well, at that, this was sort of accidental, really. I didn't even know it at the time, but Bob Gard and a colleague of his, L.G. Sorden, had established a little publishing house called Wisconsin House, based here in Madison, and they were in cooperation with Strauss Publishing, I think, at the time. And I didn't realize that connection was there, to tell you the truth, until Bob, once I'd worked this, I revised this thing, I don't know how many times. And Bob finally said to me, I think this is a pretty good book. And we might be interested in publishing it.
Wow.
Well, that was the launch of, that was my first book, which came out in 1970. And I had, this is an aside, but I had the opportunity of watching them set the type on a linotype machine. Mm-hmm. Where the flowing lead comes down and the letters are all backwards and all that. It was just wonderful to see this little book come out in 1970, in the fall of 1970.
Describe to me how you felt. I mean, many people hold the idea of publishing a book as a dream come true. How did it feel to you?
Oh, it felt that way because I'd worked so hard at it. And it was a very good feeling to have all of this together. And this is an aside too, because soon I was doing book signings, and the retail price of the book hardcover was $5.95. And people would say to me, as if I were pricing the book, how in the world can you put such a price on a book? $5.95, who's gonna pay that for a book? This was in 1970.
But they did?
They did.
They did.
They did. In fact, it sold pretty well.
When you've touched upon the fact that you know, your first time you went in to Mr. Gard and showed him, you were expecting accolades, and he said, no, you got to go back. Go sit under the tree. You said you did a lot of revisions. So I want to know a little bit more about with that process of the first book. How long did it take you? How many revisions? I mean, I want to know what really went into it for those of us who aspire to be.
Yeah, that's difficult to answer. I write quickly. The first draft comes quickly. I suspect for that book, I was also teaching full time, so I couldn't work at it as much as I would have liked. But I suppose it took me, I don't know, 3-4 months to write the book and another 8 months to revise it. And the revisions, well, we just go over and over and over in what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. One of the things I quickly discovered that if you try to write an eloquent sentence, that's generally a mistake.
What do you mean?
Because that which becomes precious is difficult to cross out. So I avoid the precious. Sometimes eloquence comes through simplicity, mm-hmm. not through contrived attempts at making yourself sound literary. I've been accused of not being literary enough, and I hold it up as a badge of honor. I want people to understand what I'm talking about. I don't especially want to impress them. I hope I do, but I don't. That's not what I set out to do. I want to inform, entertain, cause people to think differently, all those kinds of things.
Simple as genius, then, you think, sometimes.
Yeah. simplicity is not simple. I'd like to write in such a way that when people read it, it looks like it. I just wrote it, and if they push me, I will tell them I rewrote that first paragraph 25 times. They say, really? Sounds like you just written it. That to me is high praise.
When you write your first draft, let's go back to that first novel. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's changed over the years, but when you write that first draft, do you just get it all out on the paper?
Yeah, I do. In fact, that's what each person is a little different. But I tell my writing students this, because this is what I try to do. I try to just keep on going until I finish the product. And that's difficult to do, because the tendency is to fiddle with it, to go back and do that. I do a little of that. Each morning when I begin, I go back and do a little tinkering with what I had done the previous day. It's kind of a warm-up and a reminder of where I am. But I don't do any major editing until I've written, and my students can understand how I can write 85,000 words and just keep chugging along, and my novels are that long, and not take a lot of time to revise. We have to, I believe, and I'm who I am, and every writer has to figure out his or her own way of doing things. But my idea is you really can't do a decent job of revising until you know what you've got in terms of a package. You've got to have the whole thing. Quick story about that. I had written this is several years later. I had written a book, and it was sort of a pseudo textbook on how to run meetings and all that kind of stuff. It sounds pretty boring. But I thought I had it done in an interesting way. Publisher in New York was interested in the work, and I had corresponded with him. And finally, this guy said, what was the name of the publisher? Just a small little publisher. He said, well, can you fly out here and meet with me? I have your manuscript. Well, I mean, that sounds pretty impressive. So this was in, I don't know, 75 or so, along in there. My first big airplane ride. I climb on an airplane, $128 round trip fare to New York City. And Bob Gard is prompting me on how to do this, and he says, you've got to stay at the Algonquin Hotel, because it's where all the writers stay, so I've got a reservation at the Algonquin Hotel. And I've never been to New York City in my life. I mean, I'm an old farm boy from Central
Wisconsin.
And was
that your first time on a plane?
Yeah, yeah.
How old were you when your first time on a plane?
No, I was in my 20s, I suppose.
Okay. So first time on the plane too.
Yeah, and here I am in New York City. I mean, I'm scared to death, but also elated, because this publisher is really interested in my work. So I get a taxi cab from Algonquin, where I'm looking around to see if I can see any writers of note, and I wouldn't recognize them anyway. Going to this little publisher's place, and it was a dumpy little place up on the third floor. Jesus, this isn't very prestigious. And the guy's sitting across from me, he's got the manuscript on the table. You know, this is kind of impressive. It was like face to face with a publisher. And he's paging through this thing, and it wasn't very long, a couple hundred pages, and he's paging through the manuscript. And finally he looks me right in the eye and he says, Jerry, tell me what your book is about. And I began to tell him what it was about, and it took me 3-4 minutes. I'm chugging along telling him what's about. He stopped me and he said, Jerry, if you can't tell me in a sentence what your book is about, you don't know what it's about. Why don't you go back to Madison and you figure that out? I was crestfallen. He never did publish the book. I got somebody else to publish it. But I learned a very valuable lesson, and now we're coming back to revision. When I finish the first draft of whatever I'm writing, whether it's an article, a column, or an 85,000 word novel, I ask myself, what is this work about? And if I can't write it in two sentences, then I don't know what it's about. I read the thing all the way through in the revision process after I've left it sit, sometimes for 6 weeks, 2 months. I just, because I'm always working on 2-3 books at the same time, I just let it sit and ferment. because that's part of the process. So I come back to it fresh. And I read it through and decide what it's about, and I write that out, and I stick it on the side of my computer, and that's my guide now for the next revision. I read through it, and whatever in that book, there's no article or whatever it is I'm writing, that does not relate to what it's supposed to be about comes out.
Is it painful to cut it?
Not a bit. It used to be, not at all, because it's really never cut. I've kept every paragraph I ever wrote. In fact, facetiously, I often say to people who don't understand this at all, they say, how are things going? I said, you know, I've got some extra words for sale. In fact, I even have whole paragraphs that you might be interested in. In fact, I have words that start with A and end with Z and on everything in between, and I will give you a bargain. I don't throw anything away. I've got it all. Every so often, I will pick something out of that slush pile of what I've thrown away, and it'll work in something else. That's why I'm not throwing it away.
And given your long, very productive career, where are you keeping? Do you now store it on a computer, or where are you keeping everything?
Oh, I keep every year's work ends up on a flash drive, which is locked in a safe. And before that, I've got disks, and I don't throw anything away. I keep it locked up, so I don't keep it on a computer. It's all locked up in the safe. And I go back to it often. I've got, how many of these flash drives now? Well, every year, one can get a whole year's production on a flash drive. I mean, if you've written 10 books, it's amazing.
You talked about your experience with the publisher in New York and that it didn't ultimately work out. So I want to talk to you a little bit about rejection. You've had such a prolific career, and you had your first book published. I mean, having your mentor have had this publishing house in the works was obviously very fortuitous. Have you experienced a lot of rejection in your career? And describe that a little bit to
Tremendous
me.
Amount, especially in the early days. And what I would say to my writing students who would ask me that very question, and I would say to them, until you have enough rejection slips to fill the walls of your bedroom, you've not done your apprenticeship. And they look at me like, what is this all about? I consider 10 years of writing a column my apprenticeship.
10 years.
Six, I suspect, is what some people often say. But it was, for me, it was a good 10 years. That's a long time. And I, during that time, I sent material to Atlantic Monthly, Reader's Digest, The New Yorker. I've been rejected by some of the finest publications in the world. And then slowly, I began to have my material accepted. $20 here, $50 there, never any money. But a sense of it's working, it's starting to work. It took a long time.
You know, 10 years, you've obviously got a day job while this is going on. Did you ever expect the writing to become your full-time day job? Or were you content with the writing being this exciting adventure and seeing your work getting published? Where did money play in?
I've never made a lot of money at writing, because what I write is not the genre I work in is not the one that's most profitable. And that's one, another thing I say to my students is to write what is of interest to you, what you really love and enjoy and gain from, and you will earn some money, but you will never get rich at it. Probably you might, but would be unusual if you do. So I tell all my students, keep your day job. Now, in terms of writing full time, my goal was always to write full time. From way back when I was in college, that's something I always aspired to. What a wonderful way to spend one's life. The reality sets in when you see what kind of income it provides. My columns were $5 a column. I had $20 a month is what I got. That doesn't do it. And with three kids, I had three kids in college all at the same time. And I knew that, in fact, at that time, my university salary wasn't even covering it. I was doing a lot of consulting. I was giving talks all over the world as a supplement to my income. But my goal was always to write full time. And when the kids were all through school and well established, in 1993, I walked away from the university and said, I'm going to write full time. And my colleagues said I was absolutely nuts because I had destroyed my retirement benefits. Well, so be it. So I've been at it, 20 some years now. So.
But you do advise young writers starting out to keep your day job.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, keep your day job. And also, I'm a little concerned sometimes with the really the young writers who have spent all their time in school and have no life experience other than school. Now that's one kind of life experience. But I benefited so much from having managed a cucumber salting station when I was in college, working on a pea viner, working on farm life, meeting all kinds of different people in all kinds of different situations. All of that has been the background for my novels and a lot of my other writing. So my students, I talked with a young woman who was just a wonderful writer from a technical perspective. And she was, I didn't say this to her face, but she didn't have anything to write about. she could write well, but she had nothing to write about. So you get out there and do something. Join the Peace Corps. Go travel around Europe. Go to the Antarctic. Do something.
After you got that first book published, talk to me a little bit then about how all these other books started to follow.
Well, after I finished the first book, I knew I could write a book, which was, I guess, something important. Now, I was faced, this is an interesting dilemma, because as a university professor, I was expected to do my fair, especially at a place like Wisconsin, I was expected to do research and writing and to get promoted, to earn tenure. You had to have a writing background. So I at the same time, for years, wrote professional academic books, maybe one a year, and then the alternate year I would write a trade book. I did that for years because I just loved the trade book, but I also got fairly good at writing the professional books as well. And tell you the truth, some of my professional books sold way more than some of my trade books. My gosh, I wrote a book called Study Skills for Adults Returning to School, which sold 50,000 copies, just like that. Unbelievable. Better Homes and Gardens featured it one time.
Well, that's one thing that also seems remarkable about your writing career. Not only the amount that you've written, but all the different forms that you've written in. The nonfiction, fiction, children's literature, academic texts.
That's because I get bored. And also, I want to challenge myself. People say, I don't want to be known as a, and there's nothing wrong with this, but that's not what I want to be, as a children's book writer or children's picture book writer or young adult writer. I mean, that's fine. But I just dabble in all of those to see if I can do it. And I discovered that I can, whatever that's worth. I write all kinds of different stuff.
Do you have a favorite form of writing?
Genre, you mean?
Yes. So do you, you know, is it your, or well, does it change?
It's changed over the years. Right now, it's the environment and agricultural history, rural history. The environment's one of my really important themes, which I have dealt with ever since I was in high school. And I'm writing a new book right now on the environment, all the difficulties that we have presently in dealing with it.
Tell me a little bit about this book that you're currently working on.
Well, it's titled, tentatively, Whispers in Shadows, where I am sharing how I came to where I am in my appreciation for nature and the environment. So there's some stories that go way back to when I was a kid on the farm, to an analysis of the history of the environmental movement and Rachel Carson's early contribution with Silent Spring, and then following through with Aldo Leopold and all of the environmentalists. I'm working all that through. And then I'm sticking my neck way out, and I don't know if it'll make it, if the publisher will agree with all of this. But I'm saying that some of the problems that we have today in paying attention to the environment rest in the assumptions of our society that success equals money earned, that materialism is all important, that consumerism is important, is necessary for the economy to continue, all of which are detrimental to a long-range view of the environment. So it's going to be fairly controversial.
We've obviously just been experiencing a great recession. How do you think that any of the materialism or consumerism has abated with the recession?
If anything, it's increased, because in my biased judgment, because we have the focus today is that what's all important is the economy and jobs, and the environment, and a concern for nature and all that relates to the environment is a detriment, an impediment, that the environment stands in the way of the creation of jobs, which just infuriates me. And so I'm writing all that and trying to do it in a civil, researched kind of way. I'm so concerned that too many policy decisions today are based on emotion and not on history and scientific knowledge. And so I'm writing about that. But I'm just into it. It's not published. It may never get published. But anyway, that's where I am with it.
Do you see, when you talk about the environment and the materialism and the consumerism of today, going back to your childhood and when you were growing up, did you think it was different? Did you think they had more respect for the land?
We did. I'm biased in that direction, but we did. And partly is because we couldn't as easily abuse the land. Is that phone picking up on here? Because my wife is at home.
We're back. Just wanted to take a slightly different tact here and go back a little bit, talking about writing and expecting writing to be your full-time living. And we were talking, I was asking you if you thought sometimes your writing is better if you're not relying on it for an income.
Yeah, my take on that is that I've never relied on writing to provide all of the income that's necessary. It just, for me, that didn't and is not working. And it doesn't trouble me at all, because for me, writing is an art form, and the benefits of writing go so far beyond the monetary value, which it's almost difficult to explain to people, that when you are writing, you are in a way discovering who you are. And that can be both unnerving as well as very satisfying. Writing helps, these are sort of cliches maybe, but writing helps one come out from behind oneself.
And you found that to be invaluable.
Oh, that is, I'm a shy little farm kid who didn't want anybody to know anything about me. And writing is akin, it's like a lot of other art forms. I'd love to be on the stage and being in plays. And here I am so shy, I wouldn't even want to talk to people. But stand me in front of an audience. I'll tell stories till the cows come home, to use an old agricultural phrase. And I do, all the time. But put me in a room with a three dozen people at a cocktail party, and I want to run for the door. I hate that. I just can't handle that. Writing helps to reveal so much of who we are. Writing for me is the way that I deal with grief. It's the way I deal with joyous occasions. It is something that when I start the morning feeling absolutely miserable, by noon, if I've gotten something written, I'm feeling so much better. And it may be junk and it may be thrown away. That doesn't matter. I've accomplished something.
Do you have to write?
I do. It's a compulsion. It's terrible. People, I had an old guy come up to me one time. He said, "You know, Jerry, what is wrong with you? You just keep on this writing. If you would get on to doing something else, you might find it more interesting." I said, "I might, but I doubt it."
So, I mean, that sort of ties back in. You know, we were talking before we paused about the environment, and I think we have a theme going here a little bit about money and about people worshiping money to the detriment of, you know, maybe your art, whether it be writing or the detriment of the environment.
See, the arts generally have suffered from this. Well, unless you can make a pile of money, why do you bother? Why would you be a sculptor? And there are always a few exceptions where somebody is making a lot of money. And so you hold that up. And people say, "Well, when are you going to be a Jim Patterson?" I go, "Well, I don't want to be a Jim Patterson. I mean, it's just because he makes $1 million doesn't mean I have to." We are so caught up. This is the environmental part. And this sounds maybe doomsday, but unless we begin spending more attention to things like global warming and water usage and air pollution and a dozen other things, there isn't going to be a place for us to be. What are you going to do with all your money when you can't breathe the air, drink the water?
Well, and on that note, and this isn't, New York Times came out, I think a few weeks ago, saying that the CO2 levels that they're recording in the atmosphere, I don't know if you saw it, and I might have, I mean, but they're the highest that they've been, I think, for like some, you know, thousands of years ago.
Sure.
So it really does seem like it's getting worse.
So anyway, that's one of the themes the environmental theme has been started with The Land Still Lives. It's an environmental story. All of my novels have an environmental theme. That's just what I'm trying to do. And I've found writing as a way, not only for all this self-satisfaction stuff, but as a way for me to teach, because I've never gotten over being a teacher. And sometimes too often, according to some of my readers, I'm too subtle, but one can introduce ideas and concepts and research perspectives and all of that through novels that you can't do through oral presentation or even in nonfiction work. I had somebody come up to me one time just really angry. I said, what is wrong? She said, "You have a character in your book. I am so angry with that person. Where would that person, how did that person come up with those wild ideas? I just can't believe somebody would think that way." I said, "I have no idea how that character would come up with those ideas." She said, "Well, I'm agreeing with you there. You can better feel that out." They didn't get it.
So do you sometimes have an agenda with your fiction work, your novels, especially your novels?
A general agenda. You got to be careful. You can't be preaching. And unless, in my first novel, I created a preacher.
Right.
If you're going to preach, create a preacher. I have preachers in several of my novels.
And that book that we're talking about here is the, I'm looking for the title, The Increase.
Travels of Increase Joseph. Yeah.
And that was your first novel.
Yep.
And so you did have a little bit of an agenda with that.
Well, I did.
You did.
It's also a conservation story.
Yeah.
But it's also embedded in it, it's a history. It's a history of a piece of land, of an area in the state of Wisconsin. I spent a lot of time digging out all of the early history and the settlement patterns and how New York, all of that's true, how the New York people came here and how this preacher came here with a strange theology, which people wonder, where did that come from? Well, I invented it. I studied Transcendentalism and Thoreau and Emerson, and they, of course, it's back to the environment. The Transcendentalism saw taking care of the land as a high level, everyone should aspire to doing that as a part of their spiritual growth. So I just made my guy a standalone preacher, and he And in that day, I also had a lot, I mean, just taken by these old itinerant preachers that would travel throughout the country, and they were firing brimstone and waving their arms and in these old tents. And I combined that with a medicine sale, a medicine salesperson. They also traveled the country selling cure-alls for whatever. I put all that together into one person. And I had lots of fun with that.
It's easy to, I mean, what comes through is how much fun you have. I mean, it seems like it's still, not only you're compelled to write, but it's also incredibly joyful.
Oh, it is. It's so fun. And this preacher, these old-time preachers always held up the Bible and were shaking it. And so I figured he had to hold up something. So I gave him a red book. He always held up the red book. And of course, the mystery is, what is in the red book? And I'll give it away if you haven't looked at the book. There wasn't anything in it. He just figured he had a symbol.
Do you enjoy, you know, you made a point to me one time that you don't always write about things that you know. For instance,
that's
you've
right.
written about the Ringling Brothers.
Now, one of the fun things for a writer is to occasionally write what you don't know, because that leads you into all kinds of areas. And when I wrote that book, the people who, and it wasn't my idea to do it. I did not want to do it. I turned it down 3-4 times. The people at Circus World Museum said, well, you should, there's a book here on the Ringlingville, which is the winter quarters of the Ringling Brothers, and we would like you to write it. And I said, I don't know a thing about it. I've never been to a circus in my life. As a kid, I never went to a circus. Never saw a circus. Don't know anything about it. Here's something interesting. They said, the reason we want you to write this book is that you don't have an agenda about the circus. I said, what do you mean I don't have an agenda? Well, we've a lot of circus historians, and they either are pro-animal or anti and all that sort of stuff. I said, I have no agenda, I don't know anything. That's why we want you to do it, because we know you know how to do research, which I do, and we know you will dig it out, and we'll help you. And pretty soon, that took me, I don't know, 2-3 years to write that book, but I am traveling all around Columbus, Ohio, finding research materials, and wading through all of the old newspapers in Baraboo, and it was just absolutely fascinating to discover all this stuff. It was more fun you could imagine.
One part I'm sort of wondering, when you're doing all this research, you're not writing, but you probably are writing because you're working on multiple projects.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. The book is called Ringlingville, USA, and I probably was writing two other books at the same time. I really don't keep track of that. Books are in different stages of production. Right now, I'm probably working on 4 different books.
And I asked you about that because I find that incredible. The word multitasking comes to mind, and I said, how can you do
that? It's really not that, though.
Explain, because you said, I said, how can you do so much? And you said, well, how can you not? Explain, how do you keep this all straight when you're working on multiple projects?
Well, probably I don't. No, I... well, just to give you an example of where I am right now, I have completed the manuscript and met the deadline for a very long book on the history of Wisconsin agriculture, which took a tremendous amount of research. I turned that in earlier in the year, in January, and it's at the publishers, and I'll expect soon now to begin receiving editorial comments about revision. So that is there. I am in about a fourth through a major sixth novel for the UW Press, for which I don't have a contract yet because I haven't written enough of it. So I'm working on that in my off moments. I do have a contract for this environmental book. The first draft is mostly finished. When I finish the first draft of the environmental book, which will be probably this week, I will set it aside and I will turn back to my novel and begin writing on it. When the material comes from, when the editorial comments come from the Historical Society Press on the Ag History book, I will set the novel aside and work on those because there are deadlines associated with those. I just last week met with I have 3 publishers that I work with. The third publisher is in Denver, Golden, Colorado. And I have, I don't have the contract yet, but I have a fairly major book with them in the planning stage on storytelling, oral, written, TV, radio, all the stuff that I do. They're interested in publishing that. So that's in the proposal stage. The environmental book is in the first draft stage. Ag history book is in the revision stage. The novel is, I'm just about a third through with it.
It makes my head spin.
No, that's it. I'm working at this full time. That's what I do.
And there's no signs of slowing down.
Oh yeah. I've got, where I've got to slow down is I can't do is, I'm 80 years old.
I know.
I just can't do as much traveling anymore. So I've got to cut way back.
In traveling, you mean to promote the books?
Yep. Or giving talks. I'm a storyteller, and people say, how do you promote all this stuff? I promoted it. One leads to another, leads to another. We've been, my wife usually goes along, I've been in the last 3 years, 70 libraries alone. That doesn't account historical societies and bookstores and all that stuff. So I've got to start cutting back. Unfortunately, the TV shows that I've recently done, I am now scheduled I'm doing a thing in Kansas City, in Lincoln, Nebraska, in Chicago, in Milwaukee, all of that's TV stuff.
And we should talk a little about the TV stuff. You're referring to public television.
Mm-hmm.
And talk a little bit about what you...
Well, that's an interesting outgrowth of this work. Well, I forgot to tell you about the other book that's done, but it's related to television. The Quiet Season, it's called, Winter on the Farm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and that's coming out this fall. And I've just completed filming an hour-long documentary based on the book. So those two are coming out at the same time, the book and the TV show. However, in promoting the TV show and the book, we're doing some live stuff at the Green Bay, Wild Rose, and I don't know where else they've got me lined up. And all that's kind of interesting, but it takes a lot of time.
So the documentary ties in very nicely with the book. And the
What they do is they use these documentaries for their fundraising, and then they give the book as a premium. So it helps everybody. It helps them and raise money for public television. And people often ask me, "Well, you must be making a pile of money doing all that TV work." There is no money in it, whatever. It's free. It's my contribution to public television, because, and now you get me off on another soapbox, I think public television is terribly important, and as is public radio, and they need to be supported.
Absolutely.
And I'm trying to do my share in doing that. But it's been great fun. And I just tell my stories, the same kinds of stories I do in my public appearances, and they just happen to be on film. And for whatever reason, that seems to work. So I'm doing a third documentary on my newest book just out called Limping Through Life on the polio background. So that will go, we're going to do two things. We're doing a 45-minute documentary that the university will make as part of I've forgotten the name, but some university television series anyway it's going to be a part of. And then we're doing a 25-minute DVD from that show, which we're going to send to the Rotary clubs all over the country that want me to come and speak, so I don't have to run all over the country speaking to Rotary groups.
And the response, we were talking a little bit, the response to your memoir about having polio has been amazing, you said.
It has. I was in Oconomowoc a week ago Sunday, speaking at a bookstore, little bookstore. 60-some people came. They were standing in the aisles. A third of them were polio survivors, wheelchairs, a lot worse shaped than I am, crutches, the walkers, and everyone with a story to tell. And to a person, all having a similar attitude as I had to not tell anybody about it, and so they were sharing, because if you can share the story, we can, and they were. So it's been interesting.
Well, you said one of the great benefits of writing was letting you get out from behind yourself. And certainly it seems like you've come full circle when you have this...
I'm back behind myself.
When you have this when you have this book that was so personal, an experience, and now you're in front of people and having them come forth and sharing with you.
See, that's been the... it's an unintended consequence in the most positive way, for both for the documentaries as well as for the Limping Through Life book. For the documentary on farm life, old farmers are coming out of the woodwork, sending me emails. I want to tell you my story, because there was and there is to a certain extent. Yet today, a negative feeling toward what farm life was like. Country hicks, uninformed, not knowing what's going on, and I'm saying, look, that was an extremely important part of our culture and still is, and let's not be ashamed, but let's be proud of our background. And so that's one of the consequences of the TV show, that people are coming forward and say, look, I was one of these old-time farmers, too, and my dog had a different name than yours, and they go on and on and on. Just like with Limping Through Life, now it's become okay for polio survivors to say, look, I had polio. I was ashamed of it for years. I didn't want anybody to know about it. I didn't want anybody to think. I think I told you this before. There was this connection, erroneous, to be sure, but still there. If you were physically impaired, you were also mentally deficient, and that was around for a very long time. Part of those of us, almost to a person, of the polio survivors, they worked so hard to overcome that mental deficiency part. They're doctors and lawyers and professors and everything else. They just way overcompensated.
I want to change course here a little bit, because I want to ask you about the publishing industry. Mm-hmm. You know, okay. We're in a time right now with the internet. There's self-publishing. I mean, we're in a huge change with that. Tell me a little bit about the changes that you've seen and how you feel about the fact that it's easier now than ever for somebody to probably publish their work, especially if they were going to self-publish.
Yeah, that's both a wonderful thing and a terrible thing. There are two horns on that dilemma, so to speak. For writers who have struggled for years and have been rejected again and again, it's now easy, relatively speaking, to be published. The concerns I have, and I've not self-published. I shouldn't say I will never do it, but I haven't so far done it. I've had a number of students in my classes that have self-published. Going back maybe a decade, self-publishing was really seen as a negative activity by everybody, especially the bookstores and libraries that would not carry self-published books. That's changing somewhat. Here's the difficulty in my biased mind, having not self-published but worked with a lot of self-published authors. The failure on the part of the author to realize that just as a medical doctor is not capable of removing his own appendix, an author is not capable of truly editing his or her own work, no matter what they will tell you. I don't care if they have a PhD in English. They are not capable. That's a little strong. Are not capable of truly editing their own work. That doesn't mean we can't revise our own work. We can, and we should, and we must. But we need an outside pair of eyes, several, in fact, to help us make what it is, what we think is so wonderful and perfect. To have that person show us the imperfections, the lack of logic, all the rest of it. And so I encourage, in fact, I almost demand of my writing students, if you're going to self-publish, you must hire. And they hire? You mean pay somebody? Yes, don't rely on your aunt. Ethel, who taught English for 20 years, to do the work for you. You're going to pay somebody. Well, who are you going to pay? Well, there are a fair number of, in most areas, and Wisconsin is blessed with them, editors who can help you. Well, what kind of an editor I need? Now, this gets, and this is how I see it, because this is how my work is edited. The first editor that you need to be concerned about is the person is called a developmental editor. And what does that person do? That person looks to see if your story makes sense, if your book makes sense, if the logic holds together, if it's worthy of, is it something that someone will read and get something out of it, at least. The developmental editors are very good at that. And then you need, I don't care if you're writing a fiction book or a nonfiction book, you need a fact checker. Somebody who will look through this book and with a very careful eye for the facts. And not only the facts that you can check on the internet and other places, but how, if you're writing fiction, on page 24, the main character has red hair, and on page 48 has brown hair. I mean, that's a factual error. You get that straightened out. Any perceptive reader will catch that. And then you need a third kind of editor. What, we need three editors, for heaven's sake? Sometimes they're all in one. And that's a copy editor. That's the person who's going to check on your spelling and punctuation. Most people think that's it. That's all you need is a copy editor. Believe me, the most important one is that first one, to decide if the thing makes any sense in the first place. If the question, what's this about, if you can answer that in a sentence, that's the person who figures that out. These people cost money. You can pay, $4,000, $5,000, $10,000, I suppose. But I'd much rather have you pay that as a self-published author than to invest that kind of money in one of, and there are a lot of charlatan publishers out there now.
I want to wrap up with just talking, you know, whenever you read in a book, there's acknowledgments. I wanted to talk a little bit about your family. Mm-hmm. Your son, Steve, the photographer.
I'm blessed from, as a full-time writer, in having within the family some very skilled editors. My son Steve has a degree in journalism. He's the only one in the family that has the credential. I do not have a degree in English. I do not have a degree in journalism. I just have a degree in life, whatever that's worth. And I have some other degrees. But so Steve is one of the most creative people you can run into. When we go canoeing in the Boundary Waters, when we're way out in the boonies and the cell phone doesn't work and nothing else works, but it's so wonderful, that's where I come up with the ideas for my novels. And he and I talk about characters and plot and all that kind of stuff. He's very, very good at that. My daughter Susan is a second, third grade teacher. She has a master's degree in reading. And she's a wonderful editor. She just tears my stuff apart like you can't imagine. My wife Ruth has a minor in English, and she's a very good editor. She looks at my stuff along the way. My daughter-in-law is the editor of the DNR magazine, and she reads all my stuff. So I am blessed to having all of what I am asking others to pay for it within my family. I'm also blessed because I'm working with publishers who have developmental editors, copy editors, and fact checkers.
And isn't your daughter following in your footsteps?
Susie's new book comes out this fall on One Room Country Schools. That's right. She's always aspired to be a writer and has had to make a living as a teacher and has two boys. And,
yep. Well, it has been a pleasure talking with you.
Well, I don't know if any of this will be of use to anyone, but that's what it's about from my perspective.
Thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
It.